Joining me today on the Culture Catch, artist, composer, musician, and all-around likable guy, from the collective known as Devo, Mr. Mark Mothersbaugh. Stay tuned to the Culture Catch. Joining us today on the Culture Catch is the wildly influential band, born in my hometown of Akron, Ohio, the Spuds, known collectively as Devo. To my left is Mark Mothersbaugh.
Greetings, mutants.
Mark, tell me about the Crypt.
The Crypt was probably the only club we got to play in Akron, and it was because a friend of mine, Rod Firestone, rented this old dump that was across the street from on Market Street, across the street from Goodyear and Goodrich, that were in the process of closing down, and he made it into a club and let us play, and so it was great for those 20 people that knew who Devo was that lived in Akron, Ohio, and it became like a cross-cultural thing when we finally started playing up in Cleveland at Pirates Cove, and Peer Ubu and Dead Boys, who were playing up there, started coming down and playing at the Crypt.
And it was a tough place. I mean, it was kind of known as a biker bar.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, you have to understand, yeah, it was a biker bar, and it was like a lot of like ex-Vietnam vets that had, you know, gone over there, got shot up, you know, got their asses shot up, and they came back, and then found out that while they were gone, the tire companies had decided, why pay citizens in Akron $7 an hour when we can pay Malaysians 7 cents a day? They started slowly shutting down the tire production and rubber production in Akron, and so these guys were like, they went to Vietnam and found out about pot and came back and were kind of confused, didn't have day jobs, and then they'd walk into this place, they just wanted to hear their favorite music and get drunk before they went home and beat the wife. instead what happened is Devo would come on stage and we'd piss them off. We were kind of like a lightning rod for hostility back in those days, and they'd get in fights with us instead, so that we might have like diverted a lot of energy that otherwise would have gone towards women that couldn't defend themselves. So we take credit for that.
Well, Rod's band, the Rubber City Rebels, Nick's band, the Bizarros, weren't they another semi-regular band, or maybe they migrated after you guys left?
That's a little after our time. By the time Bizarros and those bands showed up, we had ventured to New York and the West Coast, and we're kind of shocked to find we had an audience and much more receptive in those cities than here, in Akron and Cleveland. And so we pretty much just started getting in Ed Barger's Econoline van and driving out to the East Coast or the West Coast and back.
You guys had some pretty well-received shows at CBGB's, as I recall.
Yeah.
Critically, I mean.
Yeah, you know, CBGB's and Max's Kansas City. That was a great time for the band because it was that really special time where you don't have a record deal yet. You don't have anything. You're still sleeping in the back of a car or on borrowed sofas or whatever, and they're still not paying you to play anywhere at clubs, but there's enough energy build up that you know it's about to happen, and because you haven't signed a record deal, you haven't done anything wrong yet. So it was a great time. It was really nice those days.
What bands do you think deserve better fate than they maybe received from the Akron scene? There were so many, and I remember, you know, the Stiff Guys came over and kind of co-opted that one record, the Akron sound.
Yeah. I think they found the best stuff, personally.
Okay, fair
enough. You know, the truth of the matter is that there were very few bands in Akron that played original music.
Right.
That was not... It was not supported in northeastern Ohio at the time. So you were, you know, fighting the odds, and the truth of the matter is you probably had to lie to play someplace, because if it wasn't for the Crypt, Devo, we would get jobs by saying we were a top 40 band, and then we'd go somewhere like the Draft House or something, and we'd be in about song 7 going, okay, here's another one by Foghat. It's called Mongoloid. And then you'd have these same guys that were, you know, and you got to look at it from their point of view, too. They, you know, they're just like, they just want to go hear their favorite music and get drunk. You know, they don't really need to hear somebody, they didn't really want to hear somebody sing about, you know, sing Jocko Homo about de-evolution. They didn't even want to know what that might even possibly mean. So,
right.
So, you know, it was, we got paid to quit more times than we got to play in those days, or just paid to get out before we got killed.
No chicken wire to stop the beer bottles.
No, we ran into that over in England. There was, they used to, there was a club we played at, I think called Eric's in Liverpool, that was supposedly the Beatles, you know, first club. But when we went on stage there, they actually had the stage was totally covered in chain metal fence. And I never saw what the club looked like, because we just ran through this little tunnel and got there, and there were kids hanging on the chain fence. This is 1977. There were kids hanging on the chain right. fence, screaming and spitting, and they totally covered every inch so we couldn't even see out to see what the club looked like.
That's great.
That's my memory of chicken wire.
You guys definitely used the synthesizer in probably the most inventive way. I mean, when you guys were, you know, putting the band together, the synthesizer was the bombastic, progressive rock instrument of choice, and you guys used it in a more percussive, punk ethos kind of way. And, you know,
we were looking for sounds that you couldn't get on guitars and drums, and we wanted the sound of V2 rockets and mortar blasts, and you know, in the early days when Jerry and I wrote songs together, we used washing machines, you know, for a rhythm track. I remember he wrote lyrics to a song while we were in a car once to the sound of his windshield wipers. He was singing, "Weave to the left, bob to the right, or you'll be a flat tire on the freeway of life."
An exclusive, thank you.
And we were looking for sounds that were outside of the cliche rock and roll. Although we had a lot of inspiration, drew a lot of inspiration from the world of rock, and had a lot of influences in our music that were rock and roll, definitely rock and roll influences. Our intentions were to help disassemble rock as the primary, you know,
two guitars, bass,
forum
and drums
for pop music. And we would have gone further if we could have. We did what we could.
Well, it's apparent, because I heard the early singles before Eno came on board. You guys really had your sound before he produced your record. How did that marriage occur?
We were playing out here in 77, the summer of 77, at Max's Kansas City, and had a number of shows in a row. And at that time, it was kind of funny, because although we'd only make $100 a show, our guest list would be like Mick Jagger would want to be on our guest list, all of the other Rolling Stones, Frank Zappa's band would want to be on the guest list, Jack Nicholson, Dennis Hopper, and Dean Stockwell, and actors and and artists and musicians all wanted to be on the Devo guest list, and we just, sure, we didn't care. We were only making $100, so we'd put everybody on the list.
Right.
And one night, David Bowie came, and you know, in interviews, I'd said I wanted. People said, "Well, who would you want to have produce a record for you?" And I just always thought, "Well, David Bowie or Brian Eno." And so, David Bowie came to Max's Kansas City one night, and it was a pretty wild night. At the end of the evening, I remember sitting in a Connelline van out in front of the place, you know, because we had taken our equipment down, and we had nowhere to go, really. We didn't have any place to stay. And I remember John Lennon and Ian Hundreth and Mott the Hoople were there, and they were both kind of drunk. And I remember John Lennon stuck his head in the passenger window and sang "Uncontrollable Urge" to me from about this far away.
Wow.
Spitting alcohol-soaked saliva the whole time. But that was...
John drank? Are you serious?
I never heard that. It was definitely the appropriate song for him to sing, because the intro to it, we did an homage of "I Want to Hold Your Hand," which was the first Beatles song I remember hearing on Ed Sullivan.
Wow.
that made me want to be in a band in the first place. That night, David Bowie had come to the show, and we played a set, and we were opening for Suicide, I think. And then so Suicide came out and played, and I remember, God, what's his name, the singer?
Alan Vega.
Alan, thank you. Alan said, "Hey man, can I borrow your microphone?" And I had like a brand new $60 SM58 microphone, kind of like what you got there. And, you know, I said, "Sure, you can borrow my mic." And about the third song in the set, he was singing something, and then in the middle of it, while there's an instrumental thing, he started using it like it was a hammer, and he totally destroyed the microphone. And when he came off stage, I said to him, I said, "Why did you do that?" And he said, "Hey, the artist rules supreme." And that was his answer. And so I had a broken mic for my second set. But after we played the first set, Bowie came backstage with us and said, "Hey, I want to produce you guys." And so he came out on stage when we went back out to do our second set and said, "I'm producing this band this winter in Tokyo." And we're like, okay, because we don't have money to pay rent for anywhere, and Tokyo sounds good to us. So he said that, but he had one caveat, that there's a movie he was up for, and it was Just a Gigolo. He says, "If I get this movie, I have to be in Berlin, and we'll have to postpone the album thing."
Right,
so
right.
3 days later, he said, "Okay, I'm doing the movie, so let's do it in spring or something, or summer." And we're like, God, where are we going to stay for that long? And then Brian Eno and Robert Fripp came the next night, and we went over to Robert Fripp's house afterwards, and they both said, "Oh, we want to produce you." And Brian Eno said, "Well," we told him about the David Bowie thing, and he goes, and he was just kind of at a period where he was kind of had this adversarial relationship with Bowie that we didn't know about, but apparently he felt like he didn't get credited enough on the Low album for writing credits. And so he goes, "Hey, you know what? Let's go to Germany. I got a studio I work in all the time." It was Connie Plank's studio in Neunkirchen. And he says, "I'll pay for everything." And I go, "But we don't have a record deal." You know, Jerry and I were like, "Well, we can't afford it." And he goes, I'll take care of it all. And don't worry, we'll get a record deal. I'm sure we will." So he paid for us to fly over to Germany and paid for our recording over there. And Bowie would take a train from Berlin to Neunkirchen and hang out over the weekends, and then they'd bicker at dinner. So that's how we did our first album.
Were you at all, did that affect you, you know, being in the company of these other rock and rollers as a humble guy from Akron, Ohio? Was it heady stuff for you and the rest of the guys? Or did you just kind of take it in stride and say, wow, this is how it's supposed to be?
We thought it was pretty, well, there's some things that, I was a real, my whole life I was always a picky eater, and I always felt like food was something that you only ate because you had to, and it was just a way to waste your money that you could have spent buying a reel of tape, and you could have written three songs and recorded them. So, you know, it was like, okay, I could just drink tea and eat toast all weekend, and then I could buy another roll of Shamrock tape at Radio Shack, and I could write three songs, and you know, and then it'd be like, what do I do, or do I actually go eat a pizza somewhere? And anyhow, so he got me to eat sushi because I normally would have said no, I'm not eating that raw fish. That makes no sense at all.
Right.
But he took me to a sushi bar, and I actually went, put it in my mouth, and I thought I was going to throw up, but you know, I was with David Bowie, so you weren't going to throw up over fish. We're like, thanks for getting me to eat that. But
you guys were you out of college? Were you like 21, 22 at this?
Yeah, we were in our early 20s then. Right. But on the other hand, when we worked, I remember the one thing if I could retract anything I ever said to Brian Eno, it would be he was fishing for a comment one night while we were talking about music.
Right.
And I said, you know, I love your music so much, and I love the way you produce it, but some of your lyrics are really, what are you talking about? They're just silly. and he didn't really have a good response for me. And I didn't even at the time think that what I had said was like a foolish thing to say.
Right.
Or that it possibly could have pissed the guy off that just put up $55,000 for...
We can say it now because he can see this on the internet.
Mm-hmm. But yet at the same time, I owe him so much, and I respect him so much and love him so much. But that was the one thing I wish I would never have said.
Do you think your naivety helped you navigate the world that you were thrown into?
It worked both for and against the whole band.
Right.
On one level, it kept us really insular, which, you know, in retrospect, I think back, we had so many opportunities to collaborate with all these great artists, you know, people that wanted to work on films, people that wanted to work on our stage shows, people that wanted to work on our music, and we weren't interested because we were so excited about what we were doing.
Right.
Together, the five of us, we were so turned on by what we were doing. It didn't occur to us that we were missing out, that we may never get that chance again to work with an Andy Warhol or somebody, you know, I don't know. There was just all different kinds of situations that came up that we kind of brushed aside at the time. But, you know, in retrospect now, I think back, you know, about how things could have been different. I mean, even if we would have just done it for 1 week, I got flown to Jamaica with Bob Casale once, like in the middle of winter in Akron, like December or January of 77, 78. And Richard Branson flew us and met us in Jamaica. And, you know, we're sitting in this hotel room and with him and a bunch of the South African guys that he started Virgin with. And they had this big pile of pot, more than I'd ever seen. In Akron, we had no money and no pot, and if somebody had like one joint, you know, we'd all talk about it all week that, oh, there's this killer African weed. It was probably like oregano, and we'd drink enough wine so that by the time six people were all passing around and getting one tiny little puff, we're like going, I think I'm high, how about you? And we go, yeah, I think I am too. And it would be like that kind of thing. So when these guys are like, we're rolling these gigantic joints, we're going, oh my God. And they go, would you, here, have some. We're like, okay. So, and then I'd go to pass it back, and they go, no, no. And then I'd pass it to Bob Casale, and then he'd take a hit, and then he'd go to pass it around them, and they go, no. And then they'd pass it to me, and they go, what do you guys think of the Sex Pistols? And we're like, oh, great band. We were just partying with them last week in San Francisco. You know, we played the same weekend they played their last show before they broke up, and they came over to this house where we were crashing. One of the editors for Search and Destroy let us sleep on the floor of his living room, and we took Search and Destroy magazines, this punk magazine, and made beds out of it and slept on. Anyhow, so those guys, they had come over. The Sex Pistols came over that night, over and the night that they broke up. And I remember Nancy and Sid, and Sid's like taking bottles of beer, and he's looking around to see if anybody's paying attention. And he would push it, and it would break on the, and nobody cared really, you know. And he was kind of bummed because he couldn't get anybody angry or upset. But you know, it was a good night. And so a week later, we're in Jamaica, and you know, we're saying, Richard, they were the greatest band. We're so sorry for you that they broke up, and we're sorry for them, and we wish them all the best of luck. And Dan, and he goes, well, I'll tell you why. Johnny Rotten is in the next room, and we have all the reporters from Melody Maker, Sounds Magazine, and New Music Express from England. We flew people down here. Johnny Rotten wants to join Devo, and if you want to, we can go right down on the beach right now and have a press conference where the three of you guys all shake hands and Johnny Rotten joins Devo. And it's like, I was like a mid-puff when he said that, and I just said, you know, they're not smoking, and I'm really, really high. And it was one of those things where, you know, like...
Does anyone... I've never heard this story. This is
true,
an amazing
story. It's a true story. And I remember Bob Cazale and me, we were both like, all of a sudden it's like, oh, we thought we were just, we realized we weren't just there to get out of Akron, and it wasn't just Richard being a nice guy because he'd signed us. It was this other thing that neither of us had ever contemplated, nor did we even think it was a good idea.
Right, sure.
And we're like, it's like, you know how like, you know, those things like where, you know, you're at a funeral, you're in church, you're at school, and it's inappropriate to laugh, but somehow everything is absurd, even just because it's so wrong, and you're
right.
Just like, and I'm like laughing, and I'm going, Richard, I'm stoned, you know, so I'm going, Richard, I'm not laughing at you, man. And I'm laughing really hard. I'm going, you know, that's really, God, what a compliment, you know, but I got it, you know, and it was one of those really weird, and so we ended up spending then like 5 days with all those guys, and it was really, you know, uncomfortable.
Yeah, sure.
For me, and Richard almost killed us in a Jeep accident that we had up in the mountains, but that was one of those things where, in retrospect now, we should have just gone to the beach and go, sure, yeah, Johnny Rotten can be in Devo, and then just taking him back to Akron for 1 week and let him,
and he would have quit.
Let him enjoy the, you know, where we were staying, and you know, on somebody's living room floor, and he would have been ready to go back home.
Well, in many ways, you could see how Pill evolved then, Public Image Limited. Mm-hmm. You know, it certainly co-opted a lot of your sound. How do you feel about the bands that co-opted your sound? Are there any in particular that you say, wow, they took our thing and they maybe tweaked it to a way that we didn't think of it, or did a shitty job of that?
No, there's a lot of stuff we heard and we go, damn, we should have done that.
Yeah.
or we think that, you know, or people would say, you know, you guys inspired us, and we go, yeah, and you did a much better job at it than us. You know, people like Green Day, I remember Kurt, you know, was a
really?
Big fan, and was very, you know, told me he thought we were a major influence. And there was a lot of bands, you know, like electronic bands. The thing that always was curious to me is that it seemed to be from a wide genre of people that were turned on by what we did. And I like that. I found that really complimentary. But I don't think anybody... You know, the only thing that ever bothers me with that is when people sample you, and some of the stuff, they don't even add anything new of their own.
Right.
They just take a brief passage of a song where they take just like one great hook and then play it over and over and over again. You know, like a lot of that stuff. And then they come to you and say, well, we've written a new song.
And
you're like, no, you haven't. You just took one piece of our song and played it over and over and over again. So, you know, so those are the people I take issue with. I don't, and sometimes I even hear good stuff. You know, there's like a band called Subthunk that did some remixes of like Jocko Homo and did it super cool.
Right.
But other than that, I like it when people, I like finding out that people were turned on by us or influenced by us. And I mean, I was influenced by everything that was going on around me, you know.
You got your left hand, you got your right hand. bed. Always do what your mommy has said. Brush your teeth the following way. Wash your hands 3 times a day.
Influenced by what Alan was doing in Pere Ubu or Rocket from the Crypt?
Oh yeah, I thought Alan was a.
Was he the revolutionary guy with the synthesizer from that time period, or were there other guys?
Well,
he was
know,
getting weird. I mean, both you guys were really getting great sounds.
We were doing slightly different things.
Yeah,
I really liked what he did, and I liked what he did back when the band was doing something totally different. I loved it when they were doing 60 Seconds Over Tokyo,
right,
and Non-Alignment Pact,
right,
and all their, and that was only like kind of like a dozen or so songs, and then they kind of went cuckoo.
Right.
And I always felt bad that they went off the deep end, because I thought what they were strongest was bringing different worlds together, and I loved their pop songs. But that's just my take. I'm sure most people like their other stuff better.
Oh, I mean,
interesting. But he was good. He was great.
Yeah,
and
and
I like he did things that were more, you know, like John Cage sounding.
Mm-hmm.
What I thought was different between me and him is I thought that my sounds were specifically influenced by the song I was doing, and his. I felt like a lot of his stuff you could have taken things out of one song and put them in the next, and he kind of did that from night to night. It wasn't always that specific,
right?
But he was definitely on the right track. He had an EMS, EMS or EML? I think he had an EMS,
right,
the English synthesizer, with no keyboard, and I thought that's great. You know,
what were you using primarily?
Mini Moog and an Arp Odyssey.
Right, and they're back in vogue now. The kids, you know, you go to the shows and everyone wants the retro gear. Join me next week for part two of my interview with Chief Spud, Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo. I'd like to give a shout out to our sponsors, Final Draft, and to our amazing editor, Mr. David Lee. This is Dusty Wright for The Culture Catch. We'll see you next week.